Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Weiss. My registration is 27553. I'm a public defender, and I'm here for Mark Paulson. As a lawyer, occasionally I get asked questions about jury service, and people like to tell me about times that they've served on a jury. And occasionally, one of those people will say to me, you know, I can't believe they left me on that jury. And I think this case is one of those occasions that this juror, K.E., falls in that category. I would like to jump right to the first issue and right to juror K.E. because I think that's the heart of this case. Juror K.E. is the one who served on this jury. And so what's at issue is the right to a fair trial under the due process clauses. The very last words that juror K.E. said in this case during the voir dire is, yes, I would like the defense to prove insanity. Of course, the problem with these words is that the defense doesn't have the burden of proving insanity. In fact, the opposite is true. The prosecutor is the one who has to prove that the defendant is sane. But you can't look at this one sentence just out of context, right? Because this court's job is to look at the totality of the circumstances and all of the statements that were made by this juror. So I can lay it out for you. The context in which this statement arose was during the defense voir dire. And what they were talking about is whether the insanity defense is a cop-out, is what some of the people were saying. Whether it's a way for people to avoid accountability when they have no other defense and they're actually guilty. To this conversation, juror K.E. said, well, it's also a way to avoid ownership. Ownership is perhaps also at issue. And the defense lawyer asked her to elaborate on that. And she said, if somebody does something and it's proven that they've done it, they are guilty. So defense lawyer said at this point, well, perhaps you don't understand. Let me explain to you that under the law, mens rea and actus reus are under equal footing. That's the law. And she says, yeah, I do have a problem with that. So then defense lawyer says, well, what should we do with this mens rea? Should the defense have the burden of proving it? Does the defense have a burden of proving insanity? And she says, yeah, I would like it proven. Does that make sense? That the defense needs to prove that he was in an insane state of mind. And then the defense lawyer, just to make sure that we're not misunderstanding, to confirm, says, you would be looking to the defense to prove insanity. And the answer is, yes, I would like the defense to prove insanity. And that was the very last thing this juror said, and she was never rehabilitated. She never said anything else after this. There's a defense challenge for cause, and the judge's ruling is this. The juror's statements are common sense, and that he didn't have any impression that she would not follow the law. Here's the problem with the trial court's ruling, is that it might be common sense for a juror to say this if they had not been previously instructed on the law. Right? Because sometimes that happens. A juror will come in and say some preconceived notions expressing bias or something, and then they're instructed on the law, and then once they hear what the law is, they say, oh, well, now I understand I can do this. That's not what happened here. What happened here is that when the voir dire started at the very beginning, when the jurors were brought into the courtroom, and the bailiff is being introduced, and the court reporter is being introduced, the lawyers are being introduced, the trial court introduces some of the bedrock principles of criminal law right at the outset, right at the get-go. He says, the prosecutor has a burden of proving sanity. The defendant does not have to present evidence. The burden lies with the people. That was one of the very first things. It's on page 17 of the voir dire. It was right at the beginning.
Pardon me, counsel, for interrupting, but right before the question, right before the answer that you're concerned about, the defense counsel creates this problem by saying, by asking the jurors what they would like the law to be. The counsel says, as far as what you would prefer under the law, and that's how the juror answers it. And then after she gives that answer, and lots of other people give their answers, then Judge Jackson tells them what the law is and asks if anybody can not apply the law. And this juror does not respond that she can't apply the law. She says some other things during voir dire that indicate that she can apply the law. So just by answering the question, asking what she would like the law to be, why are we supposed to conclude that she could not apply the law that was given to her by the court?
Okay, That's a lot of questions sort of in one, but I'm really glad you asked that question because I would like to address that colloquy at the very end because it wasn't really raised in the briefs and I saw it when I was preparing for this argument, so I want to address that. Okay, so here's sort of how it starts, okay? There's an introductory thing on page 17. And then a lot of the jurors were having problems with this concept. It wasn't just this one. So during the prosecutor's voir dire, the trial court interrupts and says, by the way, the prosecutor has to disprove insanity as part of their overall burden. So it was in the middle of the prosecutor's voir dire that the trial court has to interrupt and say, look, let me instruct you right now because a lot of you are under this misapprehension. Let me make sure you understand this. Okay, and then there's a break. And when the jurors are excused, the judge says, please look in your heart of hearts and tell me if you can follow this burden. And then the prosecutor refers to the burden twice. The defense lawyer refers to the burden once, right before juror Katie makes his statements, okay? Then after the prosecutor's voir dire, after the defense lawyer's voir dire, the trial court says, who among you, if anyone, would tell me now that you can't do that? And by that, he's referring to this long list of things. Listen to evidence, have an open mind, hold people to their burden of insanity. Four people raised their hands in response to this, and Juror K.E. was not one of those people. So, in a way, this case raises a question of whether Juror K.E.'s silence on this particular occasion is sufficient to counterbalance her earlier statements.
Well, her earlier statement was in response to the question, as far as what you would prefer under the law, would you prefer that the defense have a burden of establishing mental condition or insanity as a legal matter? That is not asking her if she won't apply the correct law. That's asking her what she prefers.
Yes, but she also said, I do have a problem with that. I think that's pretty clear. I don't think that's saying, I would like for the law to be different. She does say, I would like it proven.
Well,
she
does one of those instances where we have to defer to the trial court's superior ability to observe her and figure out if she can be fair. I mean, the trial court did excuse some of these jurors, right?
Absolutely. But what are the findings? That's my question. What do we have about this juror's demeanor? What do we have about their outward appearance? What explicit retraction do we have of these statements? I have a problem with that, and the defense needs to prove that he was in an insane state of mind. The defense needs to prove it. That is an unambiguous, affirmative statement made during a one-on-one colloquy. And I think this one-on-one colloquy really takes greater weight over this other sort of general question addressed to the entire room where we have no findings about whether this juror was even paying attention or listening or watching, because sometimes you have that, right? Sometimes the judge says, okay, everyone's watching, is everyone paying attention? I see you nodding your heads, I see you going like this or going like this, that's great. Okay, we don't have any findings like that. We have the judge making some instructions, lengthy instructions to the whole room, and then nothing, silence. So is that silence sufficient to counterbalance this explicit statement, I do have a problem with that?
Excuse me, counsel, for interrupting you. In the time that you have remaining, are there any other issues that you'd like us to consider? Because potentially if we were to reverse on one of the other issues, we wouldn't need to address this.
That's true. I think the other issue that's very important in this case, and I think they play together, is a moral obliquity instruction. Of course, insanity is an affirmative defense. So it's in the nature of confession and avoidance, which means that all of the issues, the elements, are essentially conceded. Insanity is it. That is the main issue. So, it was particularly important that the procedures be correct with respect to this particular instruction. And if you look at the new Colge instructions that were issued in 2014, the problems that occurred in this case with respect to the insanity instruction have been corrected. So, the things that existed in this case with respect to the presumption of sanity, what I believe is a directed verdict with the moral obliquity instruction, Those problems don't exist anymore in the 2014 closing. They've been removed, and there's an acknowledgement in there that the jury does not need to be instructed. There's no need to instruct the jury that the defendant is presumed sane. This presumption of sanity in conjunction with the moral obliquity instruction, I believe, kind of works together with this issue of the biased juror, such that the defendant did not have a fair trial on the issue, the single issue in this case, which was insanity. Do you have some questions about that issue?
No, but I do have some questions. I'm going to ask your counterpart about Wainwright v. Greenfield. That's the issue that I'm concerned about, and I was wondering if you would give me your take on that issue.
Could you tell me what that held? Because I did read it right before this hearing.
A post-Miranda silence.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. You know, that's a really interesting issue because they never said he invoked his Miranda rights and then he was silent, because that's usually how we see this, right? What we have in this case was that an invocation occurred. There was no testimony. There was no language about he was Mirandized, right? But my position is that he was nevertheless burdened and by the fact that his silence was used against him at trial. So Miranda,
he had been provided, pardon me for interrupting, he had been provided with the piece of Miranda that says you have the right to remain silent before this happened, right?
Right, and Miranda is a promise that what you say is not going to be used against you. So once that promise is made, then they can't use that silence against you. That's the rule. That's only fair. And in this case, regardless of whether the actual Miranda advisement was revealed to the jury, the fact that he was silent did come in, and that's problematic. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I wanted to know your position on that.
Miranda is a promise that your silence is not going to be used against you. And it's not contingent on, well, the jury has to be told first that you were Mirandized, or it's a promise that what you say or what you don't say, well, your silence, well, if you say something, it's going to be used against you. If you don't say something, if you decide to be quiet, and in this case, he said,
I shouldn't talk
about this. And it was in direct response to the Miranda warning. And so that invocation of rights, that's an invocation which cannot be held against him and should never have been revealed to the jury. Because the jury is using this as evidence of insanity, or evidence of sanity, that he was being able to make a conscious decision about what he was saying or not saying to the police officers. The prosecutor's whole theory was that he was cunning, that this was a criminal cunning conduct. And the fact that he asserted his Miranda rights is sort of an ambiguous thing, right? Because people can decide not to speak for a variety of reasons, one of which is perhaps maybe they're insane and they have mental problems. I'm going to save the rest of my time for
you. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jillian Price, registration number 40815, and I represent the people. This court should affirm Mr. Paulson's convictions because he has failed to establish error, let alone reversible error, on any of the issues that he has raised on appeal. First, the trial court properly denied the challenge for cause to juror K.E. It is true that the last thing juror K.E. said was that she would like the defense to prove insanity. And that was in response to the defense counsel's leading and suggested question about what the juror would prefer. However, juror K.E. also said that if somebody does something and it's proven that they've done it, then they're guilty of doing it. That statement shows that juror K.E. realized that guilt must be proven rather than assumed. Juror K.E. also told defense counsel, when asked if that should be the same as the legal imposition of guilt, that she's not sure because she hadn't read all the wordage on what Colorado law says, and that they had a brief definition that she understood, but she was not sure. That shows that juror K.E. understood that she was bound by the law that the trial court would provide, as compared to any of her desires or what she would like to have happen. With respect to juror K.E.'s statement that she, quote, had a problem with actus reus and mens rea being on the same footing, that was in response to the defense counsel's suggestive statement do you find it a problem that Actatorius and Mens Rea are on the same footing? Because I think that a lot of people have a problem with that. Juror Kaye's response echoed those words, yeah, I have a problem with that. But despite Juror Kaye's statement about what she would like, she never at any point during voir dire said that she would place the burden on the defendant, that she would disregard the law, or that she would otherwise decide the case unfairly. Under all of those circumstances, and taking the voir dire as a whole, the trial court properly denied the defendant's challenge for cause. Secondly, the jury was properly instructed. The jury was instructed that a person is insane if he suffers from a condition of mind caused by a mental disease or defect that prevented him from forming a culpable mental state that is an essential element of the crime charged. The jury was also instructed that it should take care not to confuse such mental disease or defect with moral obliquity. Thus, the jury was specifically told that it should not consider moral obliquity or the ability to distinguish right from wrong in determining Paul's insanity. The presence of the definition of moral obliquity in Instruction 21 was at the very most superfluous, but it did nothing to diminish the prosecution's burden of proof. It did nothing to diminish the fact that the prosecution was required to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt and to prove Paul's insanity.
The moral obliquity instruction included an element of culpability in it, didn't it?
It mentions culpability.
It mentions culpability,
and it specifically ties that to the ability to distinguish right and wrong, which in Instruction 20, the jury was also specifically told not to confuse with a mental disease or defect. And it's undisputed that Paulson did not object to either of these instructions. Furthermore, Instruction 20 specifically says that insanity is defined as the mental disease or defect that prevents a defendant from forming the requisite culpable mental state. Taking these instructions as a whole, the jury was properly instructed, the prosecution's burden was not diminished, and a verdict was not directed against Paulson.
Ms. Price, I gave you a heads up that I was interested in.
Certainly.
And you knew that this 15 minutes would not go by without me asking. So let me ask you now, why isn't this case Wainwright versus Greenfield?
Well, in Wainwright, the defendant was read his Miranda rights after his arrest. He declined to speak with police. He invoked his right to counsel. He pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, which is similar to this case, of course. But in closing arguments there, the prosecution argued that the defendant's repeated refusals to answer questions without first consulting an attorney demonstrated a degree of comprehension that was inconsistent with his claim of insanity. And I'm quoting that directly from Wainwright, 474 U.S. at 286.
So are you relying solely on the fact that they brought it up in closing argument?
Well, yeah, they brought it up in closing argument, and as distinct from this case, the prosecution very directly and very specifically argued that the defendant's invocation of his rights demonstrated his sanity, and that is absolutely not what happened in this case. The facts of this case show that Mr. Paulson spoke with a number of police officers, but that he volunteered statements to Agent Gilbert, and those are the ones that are at issue in this case. What he told Agent Gilbert voluntarily and spontaneously was that the victims were, quote, beating on him, and that the Greek Mafia was persecuting him. Now, even if Mr. Paulson invoked his right to silence, by making those spontaneous statements, he certainly didn't exercise his right to silence. Nor, in this case, again, unlike Wainwright, did the prosecution specifically argue, or indeed argue at all, that Mr. Paulson, that his invocation of his right to silence, if he did so invoke, constituted sanity.
Well, isn't saying the words, I shouldn't talk anymore, isn't that the same as being silent under the case law? For example, if he had chosen not to say anything anymore, and not said, I'm not going to say anything, that's silence, right? You couldn't use the fact that you didn't say anything against him, correct?
Correct. You could not use the fact you didn't say anything, but...
Doesn't the case law also say that you can't say, you can't use the statement, I'm not going to say anything more against him either?
Correct. However, factually in this case, what Mr. Paulson said was, the victims were beating on me, the Greek Mafia is persecuting me, ooh, I shouldn't talk about that. Now, it is not clear, given the record and given the context in which that statement was made, Mr. Paulson could very well have been saying, hey, I shouldn't talk about the Greek mafia anymore. That was not a clear reference to his invocation of silence.
Well, I'm not talking about an invocation. I'm just saying, isn't that an expression? I'm going to be silent. And he, in fact, doesn't say anything more at that period of time. Correct?
Sure, correct.
All right. So regardless of whether the prosecutor referred to that in closing argument, isn't that using his silence against him?
No. And the way that, okay, his silence was not used against him in this case. The way that this occurred in trial, Agent Gilbert communicated what Paulson told her, victims beating on me, Greek mafia persecuting me, and all the prosecution argued was that Mr. Paulson concocted two stories. He concocted two defenses as the police were arriving.
Well, I understand that the prosecution didn't talk about this silence in closing argument. In my view, that perhaps goes more to harmlessness than whether there was a constitutional error. But so I understand the position that, you know, it might be harmless if it's not highlighted in closing argument. But the fact that it comes into evidence at all is potentially problematic, especially given the colloquy between counsel before this evidence comes in, that the judge is saying you're potentially blowing up your conviction if you bring this in. Why are you bringing this in? Think about it overnight. Counsel comes in and he asks the question. So the issue about whether this was using his silence against him was absolutely present before the testimony came in. So I guess I'm just having you, what I want you to explain to me is how that is not using his silence against him, especially given the prosecutor's statements that this is to show that he was safe.
Well,
to the court, like statements to the court outside the jury.
Okay, statements to the court outside the presence of the jury. And the next day, after the prosecution had thought about this, it retracted its request to introduce Mr. Paulson's silence. Agent Gilbert testified that he said, victims beating, Greek mafia, I'm not going to talk anymore. Or I shouldn't talk about this, is what he said.
That's the question. And that was the question that was initiated in the colloquy with the court the day before.
Right. And the prosecution, again, on the next day, outside the presence of the jury, told the court that it was not going to introduce Mr. Paulson's silence. And it didn't. It introduced what Mr. Paulson said to Agent Gilbert.
I understand your position.
Because the challenges for cause were properly denied, because the jury was properly instructed, and because the prosecution did not use Mr. Paulson's silence as evidence of his sanity, this court should affirm his convictions. Unless this court has any further questions on any of the issues, the people would stand on the briefs and request that this court affirm Mr. Paulson's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes.
Okay. I just want to address harmlessness on this issue. The prosecutor said when he was arguing for the introduction of this statement, I shouldn't say anything further. He said the purpose of introducing this evidence was to show that that is a rational, logical response to the police to rebut the irrational Greek mafia theory. So the prosecutor's purpose in introducing this evidence was to rebut the implication that the defendant was insane. It was offered as evidence of sanity. That was its purpose. Whether or not it was explicitly argued that way to the jury in closing, that was the relevance argument for why this evidence should have been admitted. So the prosecutor's own theory of admissibility, I think, is relevant for why this jury would have used this evidence. And then my other thought also was that during the closing argument, the prosecutor argued that Mr. Paulson's statements to Agent Gilbert, and those statements were, I shouldn't talk about it anymore. His statements to Agent Gilbert were cunning and made by a criminal mind who knows what he's doing and knows what he's done and capable of formulating the intent. So based on this entire record, our position is that the statement was used as evidence of sanity, And because also the jury included a biased juror, under all of these circumstances, the defendant's right to a fair trial and his Miranda rights were violated.
And I have a quick question for you. Does it matter? Does it make any difference if a defendant says, I'm going to exercise my right to silence, and then doesn't, and then just starts spouting off and saying incriminating things?
I don't think that particular statement would come in, ever. If he says stuff later and he's volunteering them, then maybe those other statements come in. But that statement right there, I'm not going to talk, I'm going to be silent. The import of that is that it communicates to the jury that the negative implication of it, of course, is that he knows that he's guilty, that he's done this, and he's trying to figure out a way out of it. When the law actually recognizes that the statement is ambiguous and it can mean a lot of different things. So, yes, if you volunteer statements later, then those volunteer statements can come in. But that one statement and any immediate silence that follows it, that can't come in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your fine arguments. This case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And we will.